It's nearly always the case, perhaps always the case, that understanding the context in which Scripture is written helps us to understand how to respond to it, how to read those things that aren't at first sight obvious. And here in Matthew, it's no different. The question that is being asked of Jesus is the third controversial question that has been put to him. It's described variously as a test question, although if you look at the questions before, they were asked, it seems, to trap Jesus, to get him to bring out some response that would damage him in the eyes of the people. And just before these particular three events, things always seem to happen in threes, don't they? Jesus has actually told three parables. He's told a parable about two sons, he's told a parable about wicked tenants, and he's told a parable about a wedding feast. And those parables challenge the Jewish authorities. They challenge and question their inaction. They challenge and question their disloyalty, and they challenge and question their standing before God. And they must have realized all of that. And if they'd taken it to heart and recognized how truly those parables reflected their state, they would have repented bitterly. But they did not. Instead, they respond with these three controversial questions, hoping to put Jesus in some kind of impossible position and damage his standing with the people. Let's remember that it's almost certain that it was only Jesus' standing, his popularity with the general people, that prevented the Jewish authorities moving against him and eventually executing him. Jesus had responded in turn in a forthright way. He'd exposed their motives and their ignorance. The first question had been about the paying of taxes to Caesar, and Jesus had disarmed their question by asking them whose head was on the coin that was given to him. And then there'd been the question of marriage after the resurrection, and Jesus had told them that they didn't actually know what would happen after the resurrection, and therefore he had spoiled their game there as well. And then comes that question we read today, which is the greatest commandment in the law? I wonder if you'd been asked that question without any prior knowledge of what everybody else had said, what your answer might have been. Would it have been the same? Would it perhaps have been given from a different viewpoint? We could perhaps argue that the greatest commandment was not to kill, because that was the one that had the most effect on the general population. You might have argued the most important one was to honour your father and mother because of what they had done for you. But Jesus instead gives his answer. We read that this question was not particularly asked to trap him, but rather to test him. And indeed, the whole way in which he's asked seems to be a little bit different. If we look in Mark's account, we see that the way in which that proceeded was rather more friendly. The question is fundamentally different. It's by no means so controversial, but it does test what Jesus was going to say on this very important point. It's perhaps testing how orthodox he is. And actually, when we come to Jesus' answer, we find that it was extremely orthodox. You couldn't get more orthodox than the response that he gave. The first verse that Jesus quotes in Matthew is Deuteronomy 6:5, which we read today. It's known as the Shema. It's the basic essential creed of Judaism. It's the sentence which Jewish worship generally begins with. It's the first verse that Jewish children actually commit to memory. And what it means is that God is asking for a total commitment, a commitment which knows no boundaries. It's not just following a few rules and regulations. It's asking for a commitment to whatever he says, whatever he asks, whatever he reveals in our lives, and whatever it might cost us as well. The second verse that Jesus quotes is from Leviticus 19, verse 18. And since we are all made in the image of God, we must love each other as we love ourselves, because that is part and parcel, really, of our relationship with God. But this is not referring to sentiment. This is referring to commitment. And we can, and indeed we are called to this sort of love, even for people we may dislike, people we might find irritating, people we might find unreliable, and so on. That doesn't matter at all. We are still called to be committed to them. Now, naturally, we do need to unpack that a bit in our lives in order to apply it in practice, and so obey these commands. But in verse 40 of this passage we read, Jesus is saying that everything else hangs or depends upon these two commandments. Without them, the rest of the Bible is not understandable. It cannot be obeyed if we are not keeping these two commandments. One commentator puts it this way. He says, "With God first and neighbour second, all else is commentary." Well, that said, perhaps sometimes we do need a little bit of commentary, because we can have blind spots as to what these commandments mean, and we need to tease them out for ourselves. Sometimes we need to listen to other people helping us understand what they mean. And the two commandments go together, but loving God comes first, because we cannot truly love other people if we do not love God. If we do not recall that our neighbour, even that rather irritating person, is actually made in the image of God. And this has to be a real challenge in many ways, doesn't it? It has to be a challenge to the inequities of our world and our country. Are we loving our neighbour as a community when some people might struggle to keep warm while others enjoy their private planes and boats and threaten to leave the shores if their taxes are raised a little bit to help keep others warm? So perhaps we shouldn't cease to complain to our politicians about the state in which we find ourselves. On a personal level, we need to look at our own involvement in modern society. It's a very consumerist society. We may need to look at whether we really need that latest little gadget that we purchased, whether we need that new kitchen, that new car. We should question the sourcing, the consequences of the purchases that we make. Are the end producers of items such as coffee and clothing being treated fairly? Are we just profiting from unfair circumstances? Are we looking out for our own neighbours who may be in financial difficulties, might be ill, might be just lonely? There's another incident recorded in Luke where Jesus is asked the question, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And he turns it around and says to the questioner, "Well, what would you say?" And essentially, the person who asked the question came back and gave the same answer that Jesus gave in this passage from Matthew. It's followed up by the question, "Who is my neighbour?" And that then, as you probably recall, leads to the telling of the parable of the Good Samaritan, which effectively says that everyone is our neighbour. It's a principle of love and commitment that we're actually being called to here. And it's a costly business as well sometimes. It certainly was for the Samaritan. If you remember, he gave over silver coins to care for that man's bills. And there's no limit to the scope of that command, just as there's no limit to God's love for each and every one of us. It should be said in passing that sometimes love has to be what we sometimes call tough love. Children need disciplining. Criminal behaviour must be dealt with. Public order needs to be maintained. Our own faults and failures need to be addressed, even when that is quite painful. But that said, the command to love our neighbour is actually secondary to that of loving God. And whilst it's clear that part of loving God is loving our neighbour, it is only a part of it. If we only did that, then we would limit our response to social work, to political campaigning, and important as those responses are, they are not the totality of loving God by any means. And here I come to another analogy. One way of thinking about this whole thing might be to imagine that we are guests in the home of our best friend. Now, if we were guests in the home of our best friend, we would behave in certain ways, wouldn't we? If that friend had other guests or children, we'd expect to be friendly and cooperative with them. We'd want to avoid abusing any hospitality offered, so we'd want to clean up after ourselves when we use the bathroom, for example. We would want to fit in with the routine of the household so that our friend's family was not disrupted. We wouldn't want to cause any additional work or inconvenience to our friend. We would want to spend, hopefully, some time with our friend, not simply use their home as a hotel base from which to go and do our own thing. If our friend had some pet animals, then we'd behave in a friendly way towards them as well, even if we weren't particularly fond of cats or dogs or whatever it is that they had. If our friend told us that things worked in a particular way in his household, we would want to go along with that way. We wouldn't want to disrupt things. Now, I want to suggest to you that actually we're in exactly the same position before God as we would be if we were guests in the home of our best friend. We are guests of God living in his world. He has designed it to work in a particular way. We do have to share the space with other people, but also with other species. And it therefore follows that we have analogous responsibilities and obligations towards God. God should be our best friend, someone we put aside time to speak to and to listen to, not just using his world as a base from which to do our own thing and enjoy ourselves. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. We are guests of God. All we have, although we may have worked for it in some ways, is still not ours. It is on loan to us. We are tenants or stewards. Now, it's certainly true, if we read the Genesis account of creation, that mankind was the pinnacle of God's creation. But it's also true that God pronounced all the rest of his creation good. We sometimes read the words rule and subdue the earth in the wrong way, as meaning that creation is ours to do with as we wish. A truer reading would be that we are stewards of what God has created. So in fact, it's not just permissible, it's actually in fact required that we are concerned for the environment in which we live, that we are worried about issues such as global warming, deforestation, the destruction of animal habitats, cruelty towards other animals, creatures whom we should be caring for. And of course, we shouldn't either forget future generations who come after us. They will inherit what we leave behind. The world isn't suddenly made new for the next generation. They will have to live with the depletion of resources that we leave behind. They'd also have to live with the political and social situation that we leave behind us as well. Now, of course, we do live in a fallen, in an imperfect world, and in turn we may be limited in what we can do, but we are called to use our resources to respond to God in a loving way by looking after his creation. Sometimes we do have clear rules. We do have the commandments that say, do not steal, do not commit adultery, do not murder, and so on. But they are just part of the commentary on the two great commands, because if we love God and we love one another, then none of those things will enter into our minds. But in other cases, we may need to work out for ourselves how best to respond. Global warming was not a problem that those of Jesus' day grappled with, for example. And sometimes it requires a bit of effort to work out what the best way of approaching things is. Sometimes we need to recognize limitations that we may have to work within. Sometimes it's more important. Sometimes we need to do it together rather than alone. Certainly that would be the case with something like global warming, which knows no boundaries. So we need to love God in the way that we care for and the way that we live in his world, as well as our response to other people. The remaining part of our New Testament reading, we have Jesus' turn to ask a question. And he turns things around. He doesn't ask this question to embarrass them, or to show them up, or to win an argument. What he's doing is trying to confront his questioners with the scriptures, get them to reassess the way in which he knows they have envisioned the Messiah, and why they cannot and do not want to accept him. Sadly, they don't take this particular opportunity to re-examine their attitudes and perceptions. And the question we should be asking ourselves is whether we are set in our erroneous views in some ways, small or large, in the same way that they were. Are we open to Jesus' challenges to us this morning? If on something that we've heard or thought about this morning, we've always had a fixed view and thought of it in one way, are we actually opening to questioning that particular view? William Barclay calls these six verses new horizons. Now, no doubt we've all struggled with many things in life. Struggled with the injustices that appear in our world. Struggled with the apparent contradictions between God's providence and human will, perhaps. And certainly that's been going in every generation that has gone before us. Job struggled with the truly horrific events that occurred in his life. Remember, he lost his possessions, he lost his family, and then he was struck down with a terrible disease. At the end, his fortunes were restored, but he never found out why that happened to him. He had to live with that. The author of Ecclesiastes begins the whole book by saying that everything in life is meaningless or futile, and goes through a whole adventure or journey trying to determine what life is all about, and yet comes to that conclusion at the end that now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter: fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And he goes on to talk about judgment as well. And from Jesus this morning, we see clearly that everything hangs on these two commandments, on loving God and on loving others. That's the way in which we need to focus. We should not go around having a long list of rules and regulations. That's what the Pharisees and the Sadducees of Jesus' day did. We need to look at those two commands and work out how we can put them into practice in our own lives and our own communities. So I leave you with the question, how well are we actually following these two commandments on which everything else hangs?